Is America headed for a debt crisis? If it is, what can you do to safeguard your own wealth? Here with some smart ideas for navigating your financial future is Ray Dalio. Ray is a legendary investor, founder of the Bridgewater Hedge Fund, and number one New York Times bestselling author of the book, Principles. In his new book, Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises, he drills down into the specifics of what happens when financial systems break down and what policymakers and ordinary investors can do about it. Here's Ray.
Hi, I'm Ray Dalio. I'm the founder of Bridgewater Associates, the world's largest hedge fund, and the author of Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises. The book is an extension of what I've done for over 50 years. You see, I'm a global macro investor, so I need to have a practical understanding of how global markets and economies work. And the most important thing I need to understand is how the money and debt dynamic works, because it drives just about everything in the markets and the economy. For that reason, I studied all the big debt cycles in all the major countries over the last 100 years. Having that understanding allowed me and my company, Bridgewater, to successfully navigate most big financial crises, most notably the 2008 financial crisis. It's also why I was able to offer helpful advice during the crisis to top economic policymakers such as Treasury Secretaries Paulson and Geithner and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. These three men suggested that I share the lessons I'd learned on the 10th anniversary of the crisis. At the same time, I had reached the stage in my life where I realized that one of the most important things I could do is pass along to others what I'd learned. So I put out this book as a free PDF, which you can find at principles.com, and a print edition that has just been reissued. The money and debt dynamic I describe in the book is like a cyclical, perpetual motion machine with the most important cause-effect relationships that drive it working in essentially the same way through time and across countries. While, of course, changes over time and differences between countries exist, they are comparatively unimportant in relation to understanding how the timeless and universal mechanics and principles work. If you understand these mechanics and principles, you will be radically better off than if you don't. There's a lot in the book, but for now, I'd like to highlight some of these mechanics and principles by sharing the 5 most important insights you need to know about debt. The first insight is that if you understand the major parts and major players that make up this cycle and why their interactions naturally lead to cycles that repeat through time, you can pretty well understand what's happening and what's likely to happen next. There are 5 major big parts. First, goods and services. In other words, the stuff people buy and sell to use. Then there's money, which is used to buy things. And there's credit, which is used to buy things. But the difference between money and credit is that credit creates debt liabilities. So number 4 is debt liabilities as a piece, such as loans, you know, you owe somebody, and debt assets, such as deposits and bonds. In other words, you're owning the asset that somebody will pay you back with. Those are the main pieces, those 5 pieces. And there are 4 major types of players. Those who borrow and become debtors, that I'll call the borrower debtors. Those that lend and become creditors, who I'll call the lender creditors. Those that intermediate the money and credit transactions between the lender creditors and the borrower debtors, and they are most commonly called banks. And number 4 is government-controlled central banks that can create money and credit in the country's currency and influence the cost and availability of money and credit. These players are the biggest drivers of cycles, and they each have obvious incentives affecting their behaviors. Which leads me to my second insight. If you understand these players and their incentives, it is pretty easy to anticipate what they are likely to do and how that leads to debt cycles. It all starts with the difference between money and credit. When somebody uses money in a transaction, that transaction is settled immediately. But when somebody pays with credit, it leaves a lingering obligation to pay that's called debt. Any two individuals can create debt by one saying to the other, "Pay me later." But importantly, only the central bank can create money. Credit allows borrowers to spend more than they earn, which pushes up demand and prices near term, while creating debt that eventually requires the borrowers, who are now debtors, to spend less than they earn to pay back their debts. This reduces demand and prices in the future, creating a natural cycle. So you could see that this process creates a natural cycle of stimulation and sedatives for the economy. It's also true that what's good for the borrower debtor is often bad for the lender creditor. For example, if interest rates are too high, it will hurt the borrower debtor, and if they're too low, that will hurt the lender creditor. If either are hurt too much, a debt and economic crisis will occur. This is where central banks come in. Central banks have a tremendous amount of power because they are the only ones who create money and making it easier to pay off debts. After all, a debt is a promise to deliver money. In the scope of the history of all of the credit cycles, which goes back thousands of years, central banks came into existence relatively recently. For example, the U.S. Federal Reserve was only created in 1913, and their job is to smooth out the boom-bust cycles naturally produced by human psychology. As they do this, over time, environments will shift between those that are good and those that are bad for lender creditors and borrower debtors. And it's critical for those involved in markets and economies to know how to tell the difference. The third insight is that there are two major types of debt cycles, short-term and long-term. The big long-term cycles are what lead to what we typically call a big debt crisis. When debt, economic growth, and inflation are growing too fast, central bankers will move to slow these things down by raising interest rates and tightening the availability of money, which discourages borrowing and spending and encourages savings. When debt, the economy, and inflation are growing too slowly, central bankers speed things up by lowering interest rates and easing the availability of money, which encourages borrowing and spending and discourages savings. These actions create the short-term debt cycles that have historically been about 7 years long, give or take 3 years, which over time add up to the big debt cycles, which have been on average about 75 years long, give or take about 25 years. Over time, in other words, from one short-term debt cycle to the following ones, debt assets and liabilities tend to rise until they become too large relative to the incomes, and then they come tumbling down in big debt and economic crises. You might ask why central bankers don't do a better job of preventing debt crises from happening. There are four reasons. First, most everyone, including central bankers, wants the markets and the economy to go up because that's rewarding and they don't worry too much about the pain of paying back. So they push the limits until debts become too burdensome and they have to be restructured to be reduced relative to incomes. Second, It's not exactly clear what risky debt levels are because it's not clear what will happen that will determine future incomes. Third, there are opportunity costs to not providing the credit that creates debt, which I'll explain in just a minute. And fourth, most importantly, debt crises, even big ones, can usually be managed to reduce the pain to an acceptable level. This is especially true if debts are denominated in a country's own currency, because that allows central banks to print the money to alleviate the debt crisis. But of course, it always reduces the value of money. The fourth insight is that central banks can usually manage debt crises to reduce the pain they cause to acceptable levels by spreading out the payments. When the debt is owned in their own currencies, central banks and policymakers can spread out this painful processes of restructuring the debt so that it's not very painful at any one time. Debt burdens can be reduced in one of two ways. One way is reducing the amount of debt that has to be paid back or spreading payments out. That way is deflationary and depressing because one man's debts are another man's assets. So getting rid of the debt makes the creditor poorer, which leads to less spending. It can also be reduced by central banks creating money and credit and getting it to the major debtors to help them pay their debts. That way is inflationary and stimulative. When central banks do both together, they can get rid of the debt with deflationary and inflationary pressures balancing each other. My fifth and final insight is that debt isn't always bad, even when it's not economic, because it creates as many opportunities as challenges. Too little credit or debt growth can create as bad or worse economic problems as too much, with the costs coming in the form of foregone opportunities. Generally speaking, because credit creates both spending power and debt, whether or not more credit is desirable depends on whether the borrowed money is used productively enough to generate sufficient income to service the debt. If that occurs, the resources will have been well allocated, and both the lender and the borrower will benefit economically. If that doesn't occur, the borrowers and the lenders won't be satisfied, and there's a good chance that the resources were poorly allocated. In assessing this for the society as a whole, one should consider the secondary indirect economics as well as the primary direct ones. For example, sometimes not enough money and credit is provided for such obviously cost-effective things as educating our children well, which would make them more productive while reducing crime and the costs of incarceration, or replacing inefficient infrastructure, because a fiscal conservatism that insists that borrowing to do such things is bad for the society, and that's not true. So, you can have not cost-effective uses that improve the society, so everything can't be measured exactly that way. Also, debt crises create exchanges of wealth that reward those who know how to manage their finances well at the expense of those who don't, and they don't last very long, typically less than or up to 3 years. I hope this brief summary was of some use, and that if you want more, you check out the book or the free PDF. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ray. That was Ray Dalio with five big ideas from Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises. You might also want to listen to our book bite for Money, Magic, and How to Dismantle a Financial Bomb, Quantum Economics for the Real World by David Orrell. I'm Michael Kovnath. Thanks for listening.